All right. So the Rav, while he does have a mukkar and shas here, obviously, it takes a fundamentally different approach to the problem inside of Guralo than everyone else in the world. Rather than all the Bali Machshava that we've discussed until now. How so? We're up to page 9. The Rav's Chiddush in Jewish philosophy, Chiddush doesn't mean he's the only person in the world, but as opposed to most of the Jewish philosophers who we will, encounter, the Rav's Chiddush in Jewish philosophy, what's the biggest Chiddush? Everyone knows, any intellectual historian knows, the biggest Chiddush is not to come up with a new answer to the age-old question. The big Chiddush is to change the question. That's what really puts you in a new framework. And that's basically what the Rav does. As far as what does the Rav do? Let's look at number 9. Right? And it's not just Sadek Guralo. This is the Rav in general. The Rav changes all of Jewish philosophy because he doesn't give new answers. Because new answers are Sadek Kol working within the same framework. He gives new questions. What is the new question the Rav asks here? If you look at number 9, we'll just read the parts I bracketed. Really, we should read not just these pages, the whole essay, but that's one of these days, what we probably have already. The problem of suffering, Judaism claimed, may be raised in two distinct dimensions. The Rav says there are two different questions you can ask. Fate and destiny. Everyone remembers fate and destiny, Goral and Yud from Holodid of Fate. Judaism is always distinguishing the fate and existence of destiny. The eye subject, the fate and the eye endowed with destiny. It is in this distinction that our teaching regarding suffering is to be found. Right? There's two ways of existence, fate and destiny, and there's two different ways of asking philosophical questions, such as about Sadek Guralo. Now, first we have to figure out, which is the better way? Right? Fate or destiny? Now, we all know that because we've read the Rav. Right? What's the better way? Destiny. Right? So let's see how he says, though. What's the nature of existence? Fate is existence, compulsion exists of the type described by the mission against your will, do you live your life? A purely factual existence, one linked to mechanical chain, devoid of meaning, direction, purpose, but subject to the force of the environment into which the individual has been cast by providence without any prior consultation. The eye of fate is the image of an object. That's obviously not the preferable way of living life. You're an object, you're just bounded by forces, right? And other places we saw, he says that, basically says that the eye of fate, the ani ha gorali, doesn't have free will. You're just purely an object. The world acts on you. That's a pathetic way of living. Continuing in the brackets, it is against this background the experience of evil arises in all its terror. Right? When is this problem of Sadek Guralo, or of Ra, basically, right? The problem of Sadek Guralo is just like the next step. The problem is, why is there Ra? You can answer, because he's a Russian. What about Sadek? Right? The problem of why is there evil in the world is a big problem for the Ani HaGorali, for the man of fate who's living as an object. I'm living as an object. What is my question? My question is, why things happen to me, right? That's the question the objects ask. Why did this happen to me? Why did someone do this to me? And since the someone who runs the world is God, I'll leave it to Emes, then it's a very, very difficult question, right? Why did the world do this to me? And let's look at 4. The Rav rejects, he says, he doesn't reject as being ultimately philosophically wrong. He just rejects as being inadequate, all the traditional answers. Going on to the next brackets on page 4 of the original pages, Judaism, with its realistic approach to man's place in the world, understands that evil cannot be blurred or camouflaged, that any attempt to downplay the extent of the contradiction and fragmentation of found in reality will neither endow man with tranquility, nor enable him to grasp the existential mystery. What does he say? All the answers in the world, as long as you're asking the question of fate, why did God do this to me? All the answers in the world won't help. They won't help you leave your life. What are you going to pretend? Oh, it's not really evil. Everything's for the good. That's not going to solve everything. I know some people say yes, be Nachum Ish Gamzu and be Rabbi Akiva, and you'll live your life happily. But the Rav says no, that's not going to work. Life is still going to be terrifying, even if you have a theoretical philosophical answer. Why? Is that because the theoretical philosophical answers are all wrong? So let's continue. He says, this affirmation may only be from the infinite perspective of the Creator. Basically, is everything for the good? Of course, Gamzu L'Tova. Of course, Kol Davar Rachmano L'Tova. But of course, there's a philosophical answer. Whatever theory you get, you'll have a philosophical answer. But you know what? Only Hashem really understands the details of how that works and can see the big picture. Finite man with his partial vision cannot uncover the absolute good in the cosmos. So, not that he denies the traditional answer. Of course, he admits that there's an answer, and really Hashem is all good, and everything's latov, and there's an explanation, and everything works out in the end. He just says, Lemaisa, that is not what we need to do to live our lives, because we can't see that. That's a matter of, we know from another perspective, from Hashem's perspective, it all works out. But that doesn't tell us what to do from our perspective. Right? Because we can't figure out how that works. The contradiction exists and stands out clearly and cannot be negated. Evil, which can neither be explained nor comprehended, does exist. Only if man could grasp the world as a whole would he be able to gain a perspective on the essential nature of evil. However, as long as man's apprehension is limited and distorted, as long as he perceives only isolated fragments of the cosmic drama, the mighty epic of history, he remains unable to penetrate into the secret layer of suffering and evil. Right? So that's what he says, is yeah, it's like seeing, everyone knows the muscle, right? Why do things happen we don't understand? You're seeing like the little rug from the back with all the crisscrosses and the stitches, and you don't see how beautiful it is, but really, so the whole picture from the other side would be beautiful. The rug says, Gevaldik, but that doesn't help me, right? As long as I'm a man of faith, I'm asking the question of why did this happen to me? Why did God do X, Y, and Z? I know that God has an answer. The Rav says, that's a matter of faith. My faith is that Hashem has an answer. Obviously, from Hashem's perspective, no one has kindness on him, and he has a brilliant master plan. But that doesn't tell me how to deal with it, says the Rav. So what does? So the Rav says, basically says, you're asking the question, and the answers are all true, but that's not what we need to do to live our lives. That's not the purpose of life. That's something I have faith. I have faith in those answers. And the Rav had the same exact faith as every Yid since the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. But he said that sometimes just this like philosophical faith doesn't answer the question. So what is the answer? In the second dimension of human existence, destiny, the problem of suffering assumes a new form. What is the nature of the existence of destiny? It is an active mode of existence, one wherein man confronts the environment which he is thrown, possessed of an understanding of his uniqueness and special worth of his freedom, going on to the next page, etc. Right? He invents the pitgam. Right? Against your will you're born, against your will you die, but you live of your own free will. Al-karcha ta-nolad, al-karcha ta-meis. But in between, that's your bechir chafshis. Man is born like an object, dies like an object, but possesses the ability to live like a subject, like a creator, etc. To the next bracket, he says, basically, what's the answer? The answer is to change the question. Not to be a man, ani hagora liyus, why did this happen to me? Why did someone, some being do this to me? But to be ani hayudi, to be man of destiny, to say, I'm going to take my destiny into my hands, and the question is not, why did someone do something to me? The question is, what do I do? And as he says, for so long as the person grapples the problem of evil while still living in the existence of faith, his relationship to the problem expresses itself only in theoretical philosophical approach. He knows all the theoretical philosophical approaches to this question, and he thinks that that's not the point of life. The point of life is not to ask theoretical philosophical questions and give theoretical philosophical answers. And that's ani hagorali. Now, of course, he knows many Gedolim did that over the generations, but he would say, those Gedolim were just saying it like as a side point, you know, for those who are interested in this theoretical philosophical question, not as the real way to, not as the real answer of Judaism. What's the real answer of Judaism? And, well, continuing a little, he says, the end of such an effort can only be complete and total disillusionment. Evil derived the captive of fate in his fantasy about a world which is wholly good and wholly beautiful. Rather, what are we supposed to do? When the man of destiny suffers, he said to himself, evil exists, and I will neither deny nor camouflage it with vain intellectual gymnastics. Right, what does he think? Traditional philosophy, right? From Plato and Aristotle, etc., and as reflected in, you know, Jewish philosophers, and they discuss things in theoretical philosophical terms, is gymnastics. It's like, okay, you play a game and find a logical answer. It doesn't speak to real life. I'm concerned about evil from a halachic standpoint. What does he say? This is the Rav's idea of halachic man. What's the whole Brisker idea of halacha? Brisker's don't do tamei. Everyone knows briskers don't do tamei and mitzvahs, right? Everyone knows that briskers, right? You open up the orsamath and the rugged shavur and rechuli, and they'll give you lundas based on tamei and mitzvahs. Real briskers never do tamei and mitzvahs, right? They don't ask why. Rather, they ask what exactly. Real briskers, they don't ask why did Hashem command us X, Y, and Z. They ask, what does it mean for us to fulfill this mitzvah, right? How do we fulfill this mitzvah? And the Rav here is just taking a brisker approach to all of philosophy, including Tzadik V'Ra'lo. Briskers don't ask why did Hashem do this. That's not our business to answer the question, and the answer is not going to help us lead better lives. The answer is just that it's intellectual games. Briskers ask the question, what is my chiyuv? That's what he means, a halachic standpoint. Like a person who wishes to know the deed which he shall do, I ask one simple question. What must a sufferer do so that he live through his suffering? What are you supposed to do if you encounter evil? That's the question that we ask. And here he has a strong bucker in Shas. For example, what did the Gemara Bracha say? If someone sees Yisurim coming on him, he should examine his deeds. The Rav would say, it doesn't say if someone sees Yisurim on him, he should say, this is why God brought it on me. It says, what should you do? This is what you should do. examine your deed, that if you can't find anything to fix, then accept it me'avod. In this dimension, the center of gravity shifts from the causal and teleological aspect of evil, the only difference in causality and teleologically being a directional one, meaning we're not interested in the causality. What in the past caused this to happen, which caused that to happen, which caused this bad thing to happen? And we're not interested in teleology. Why does Hashem bring this evil to cause this, to cause that, which eventually caused a good thing? Right? We're not interested. They're all true, but we're not interested in either of them. To its practical aspect, we're interested in what we're supposed to do. The problem now formulating the straightforward halachic language revolves around one's daily quotidian tasks. Fundamental question is, what obligation does suffering impose upon man? I'll just read a little till the next brackets, even in between. The question is greatly beloved by Judaism. She has placed it at the very center of her world of thought. The halacha is concerned with this problem as a concern with other problems of permitted and forbidden liability and exemption. We do not inquire about the hidden ways of the Almighty, but rather about the path wherein man shall walk when suffering strikes. We ask neither about the cause of evil nor about its purpose, that's what we mean causality and teleology, but rather about how it might be amended and elevated. What do we do to turn this Ra into Tov? How should a person act in time of trouble? What ought a man to do so that he not perish in his affliction? The halachic answer to this question is very simple. And now you have to be, the Rav is using his lashon, like, you have to be very careful. Afflictions come to elevate a person, to purify and sanctify his spirit, to cleanse and purge of the dross of superficiality and vulgarity, to refine his soul, to broaden his horizons. Now, he doesn't mean that he's not going back on his word. He doesn't mean that Hashem brought sorrows on people in order to do this. You know, because they deserve this or because they deserve that. He means no. Sorrows are one of the things Hashem put in the world that we're, what does the halacha tell us? Everything in the world we're supposed to use in a certain way to accomplish a certain purpose. Sorrows are things Hashem put in the world. We don't know why Hashem gave sorrows to Reuven and not Shimon, or these sorrows to Shimon and not other sorrows to Shimon. But there's something. What is the purpose? What is the function of sorrows in the world halachically? That they cleanse our spirit and broaden our horizons. In a word, the function of suffering is to mend that which is flawed in an individual's personality. The halacha teaches that suffering commits a grave sin if you allow the troubles to go to waste and remain without meaning or purpose. Now, listen to this. If you let your sorrows, what happens if a person just has sorrows stam and sits around and complains, right? Then he is, it's a baltashchis. Because he's letting the sorrows go to waste without meaning or purpose. Meaning, the tzaras don't have meaning or purpose. It's not like the philosophers say. The meaning of the tzaras is, it's an onesh because you did X, Y, and Z. The rest says, could be not. Hashem has a plan. But that's not our job. Right? He's not denying the answer to the theoretical philosophical question. He's saying our job is not to ask that question. Our job is to ask, what is the purpose and meaning which I can give to these tzaras? If I use them properly, then I have given them meaning and purpose. And if I don't, then I've left them without meaning and purpose. It's up to me, and that's really, this is, I guess, sort of the existential part of the Rav, right? The existential part of the Rav, existentialism says that we give meaning and truth. So the Rav wouldn't, you know, would not necessarily, he's not a radical existential, he's not saying nothing's true in the world except for what we say and commit ourselves to, rather. But he says when it comes to meaning and purpose in these things, you know, why did Hashem, you know, there are people who get sick, have cancer. Why did Hashem give me cancer? The answer is not to ask the question, why did Hashem give me cancer? The answer is to ask the question, what should I do in this situation? And if I do nothing nothing positive, then there's no answer to the question. They're without meaning and purpose. And if I use this to change my whole life, and then, you know, let's say, someone has cancer, and then they recover and they have a completely different life because of all they've gained from it, then that's the meaning and purpose. And you don't say, I'm afraid that's why God did it. Because we don't know why God did anything. We can't know why God did anything in this world. And it's not worth asking that question. It's not Iglaimel Sarafreda. But Mikan Laba, this is the purpose of those sorrows. Those sorrows were a positive thing because they led to something. One second. Suffering occurred in the world in order to contribute something to man, in order that atonement may be made for him, in order to redeem him from corruption, vulgarity, and depravity. From out of its midst, the sufferer must arise a noble and refined, clean, and pure. Right? The difference between this and the way most people talk is very subtle. Right? What do most people say? If a school bus crashed, then Rav Avadia gets on the radio and says it's because, you know, these people were Mechalel Shabbos. Something happens because of our Chatayim. The Rav is not saying something totally foreign to that. He's just saying that from a totally opposite perspective. That we're not saying a bad thing happened to me or to us because we did X, Y, and Z. We're saying this bad thing is something given to us in the world to use to improve ourselves, and if we use it to improve ourselves and fix X, Y, and Z, then that is the meaning and purpose that we have found in those sorrows. But It's the same, almost the same, but very significantly different, because the Rav is not asking metaphysical, theoretical, philosophical questions. He is asking existential questions about how a human being lives, how a human being lives in the world.
You see that the Mamar Chazal, the explaining all the media connected medias and stories, then the Tanakh didn't learn like the Rav. Like it says, if Neymar makes Yosef Karanak, if Neshehini gets asked from Bravo. So they gave Sibos and.
So that is a very, very fascinating question. I never had a chance to ask the Rav. I never had a chance to ask the Rav this question. It could be that he would answer that Chazal had a Ruach HaKodesh and therefore were able to, in some cases, not in every case in the world, in some cases, figure things out that we can only guess at, and therefore there's no point in us guessing.
It shows you that that can be reached here before the
Correct, but the Rav might still say that can only be reached with Ruach HaKodesh. Again, I'm speaking on his behalf, I don't know, but this is what a number of people say. That can be reached with Ruach HaKodesh, and even then, it was often reached only, you know, based on Drash Sapsukim, or based on other Mesorahs, and it's not so pushy to figure out, and Chazal didn't have an answer for everything that happened to every single person, only perhaps for very special, important Gedolim, or people in certain times. So the Rav might say, yes, Chazal could do that, but we can't. I can't really know why this happens. And what's the point of knowing why it happened anyway? The point of knowing what happened is that we can do tshuva and improve ourselves. The Rav says, so forget about philosophical questions. Let's just talk about doing tshuva and improving yourself. Now, just before we broaden this a little, and tie it into the last time we looked at the Rav, the Rav has another essay called Halakhic Approach to Suffering, which is in the Torah Journal, I think. I forget which volume. And also in Out of the Whirlwind, from the Rav series, where he says, it's not exactly the same thing, but it's along the same general lines. On page 11 of mine, said, it's enough to glance at the laws of mourning or to convince ourselves that a topical halacha, by topical halacha, he means practical halacha, as opposed to like theoretical. As a topical halacha, so death is a dreadful fiend with whom no pact may be reached, no reconciliation is possible. In the act of mourning for a deceased member of the household, the whole traumatic horror in the face of an insensate and absurd experience asserts itself. Death appears in all its monstrosity and absurdity, and an encounter with it knocks out the bottom of human existence. Says when you encounter death, he was very worried about fear of death. He says there's no good answer. You're not going to feel better. It's monstrous. It's terrible. It like is against everything we ever think, whether for a secular person who thinks about living a secular life, or for a religious person who thinks about all the Torah and mitzvahs and all the things he wants to do, etc. Right? Death just knocks that all out. And we don't deny it. Even though we believe, right? People say he went to a better place. Right? But we don't deny it, then why should we help Zavelis? We should make a Kiddush and have a big party when Tzaddik dies, because he went to a better place. So the bigger Tzaddik someone is, the more we should cancel Avelis and instead have a Chasna. But we don't do that, he said, because he knows the theoretical philosophical answers don't take away the existential reality that death is a very difficult thing to deal with. So he says it's such an attitude in sharp conflict with the metaphysical physics of suffering. In short, the practical topic of love did not could not evolve the metaphysical suffering. Yet, theoretical Jewish thought has all the answers. But halacha, practical, which for the Rav, halacha demanded, the ikker, did not explain away suffering. It simply refused. It was not eager to find the rationale of evil to convert the negation to an affirmation. Right? Halachically, our job is not to explain why it's really good. Even though there is such philosophy, it neither and Hashem knows that it's true. It either justified evil or denied and hate it. But that's not our job. Our job is to live as Yishei Halakha. The topic of Halakha always held the view that evil exists, that man must face it in perplexity and embarrassment. Yes, the topic of Halakha has evolved an ethic of suffering instead of metaphysical suffering, right? We don't have metaphysical questions about that's not how we deal with Tzaras. We have an ethical question. Ethical meaning not, you know, like Ben Amachavir, like something who's ethical. Ethical meaning about what to do. You know, practical. The Sofa, I would say that Halakha, ethic of suffering rests on three propositions. Right here, he talks a little differently about how you're supposed to face suffering. First, evil does exist and evil is bad. And then he says, second, one must never acquiesce in evil and make peace with their condoned existence. Here he takes a slightly different approach. He says, and you should try to fight evil and reduce it, right? If people die, you should try to invent new drugs and medicines and cure them, etc. And he says at the bottom of this page, he's saying, Allah has always preached active opposition to evil. Right, after all, why don't we say that, you know, if people die, it's from Hashem, so we shouldn't do anything. He says, no, you're right, Hashem has it all worked out. And if the person would have died and no doctor would have treated him, Hashem would have a reason. If the doctor would treat him, Hashem would also have a reason. So what's the difference? Either way, Hashem has a reason? No. It's our job from a existential practical perspective to fight evil. And the third proposition, he says, one second, is faith. On the original page 16, if man loses the battle in the war, the top of the left always believe based on his chronological vision that some future date, some distant date, evil will be overcome, evil will disappear. What helps us fight this battle? That we know that eventually in the world will be perfected and bila hamavis lenetzach. But none of these three things is to understand that evil is really good. Even though he admits that's philosophically true, but that's not the question that we're supposed to be asking.
I don't understand, though, why did the Rambam and Hilchos Teshuva that included the discussion of why bad things happen in the halachos? Like, he quotes the psukim about Mifili and Lotetzei Haros Vato and all these things. So, what is that doing in the halachos sefer? You should put that in the morning book. Is he against the briskets from the Rambam himself?
That is first of all, I wouldn't say all briskets. The Rav is the one who's taking this brisker approach and applying it to philosophy. I don't know what Rav Chaim would have done. Rav Chaim might have just said, I don't even want to discuss philosophy in the first place, for all I know. Or he might have said, I don't know, go speak to a philosopher. But I hear your time. That is why the Rambam putting Scharva Onish into Hilchos Teshuva, unless the answer there, he's not putting Scharva Onish into Hilchos Teshuva because he's saying that, you know, part of Teshuva is that we have to figure out the Scharva Onish of the world. Could be he puts Scharva Onish into Teshuva because we have to know that we have to be afraid of the Yom HaDin when we do Teshuva. That part of Teshuva is, of course, you have to know that Hashem's going to, you know, that Eina Shol Beis Manos Lach, and that and you both have to know the strictness of the Din in order to have proper Yira, and you also have to know the Midas HaRachmim in the Din in order to be inspired to do Teshuva.
You can't really have this dissection, like what the Rebbe wants to do between the philosophy and Agada and like Halacha. Like, the Rebbe wants to cut it.
It just means that you have to do that you have to do it carefully. We'll come back to that in a second. You have to do it carefully, and I think we mentioned some of these things previously. You have to do it carefully and know when certain things that seem philosophical have to be part of your halachic way of living in the world and when they don't. And he might even say you have to move Dayak and the Rambam and figure out what's what. I'll just briefly point out on page 12, I won't read it all, but here he discusses, he calls thematic halacha, that means as opposed to topical philosophy, how Jewish philosophy dealt with evil. And he basically says that evil is not a pleasant guest, but somehow we put up with it. And what do we say? We say that, all the suffering that happens in this world is to make it better for you in Olam Haba, and that's the most classic, widespread answer. And he agrees with this. But he says, the last page, Isaiah 13 of the original, he says, can such a metaphysic bring solace and comfort to modern man? That's the question. If you just have philosophical, theoretical answers, does that help modern man in his predicament to the world? Now, someone might say yes. But the Rav says, someone might say yes. No matter how much evil I see in the world, if I really understand that it's all the Tov and it's all to make us better in Olam Haba, etc., then I'll feel better. The Rav says this question is not an easy one. I personally have not been too successful in this. And therefore, he says we have to take the, what he calls Tatka Halacha, the practical man of destiny approach and not the man of fate approach. Now, you could agree with him or disagree with him, but this is the basic sheet of the Rav. The basic sheet of the Rav in philosophy, like we mentioned when we discussed Emunah, I think we emphasize the same theme, is that theoretical, metaphysical, traditional philosophical questions and answers are not going to address the concerns of modern man, and that is not just because we are modern, that's because the Ikaron, Judaism is based on halacha, it's based on what you do and what you experience, and not figuring out the answer to philosophical questions about God. And that seems to go Ral and Yud, that Judaism is about Yud, and that's from a brisker perspective, taken to the realm of philosophy. It's about what we do, and what we should do, rather, and not about the answers to metaphysical questions. And, you know, this ties into what we mentioned when we discussed Emunah, right? That the Rav living after Kant and being some sort of post-Kantian, Kant basically proved that philosophy couldn't really answer questions of metaphysics and theology, etc. Because all of our philosophy and science and all of our knowledge is based on in this world, in the practical, scientific, physical, human world, and no amount of putting together different building blocks from this world, from this realm, can prove things about another realm. Just like no amount of math can prove things about zoology, right? And no amount of zoology can prove things about medical ethics, right? Because just like you start with zoology, that's just facts. Fundamentally, they can never prove anything about medical ethics, which is about values. Like, you can't prove anything in a higher realm. Okay, he had words for these realms. So the Rav basically agreed with this. The Rav says philosophy cannot really, philosophy, he took things together, right? On the one hand, the Kantian approach said philosophy doesn't have the answer to metaphysical questions. If you asked the Rav how he knows God exists, he wouldn't talk to you philosophy. He'd say, ah, that's the mystery of faith, that a Jew has a mysterious faith and he knows that God exists because of some, you know, mystical power, not because of philosophy. Unlike the Rambam here, and he, you know, as we saw in the footnotes of the Only Man of Faith, he said he even read this into the Rambam, whether you like the reading or not. One second, Donnie. and the Rav being a Brisker. And Briskers don't like the reading of things. They don't like explaining God. They like explaining, right? They don't explain why God said X. They like explaining how we are Mekayim X. And that's a classic Brisker approach. So this is the Rav's general approach. He denied the traditional question of philosophy. Not denied you could ask them to answer them, but denied that that's our job in the world. Our job in the world. That's why you always talk about halachic man. What's halachic man? What it means to be a halachic man. Halachic man never tells you, never proves to you that you should follow halacha. Because that he's not interested in that, right? What does he say in Lonely Man of Faith? I was never bothered by Bible criticism, right? By all these questions, documentary hypothesis, and this and this. I was never bothered by it. Why was he never bothered by it? That's a question for Ani HaGorali, you know? Can we prove that Hashem wrote the Torah in someone Taina that Fakeret? That doesn't bother me. What bothers me, right, when he sees two different stories of creation of Adam Arishon, it doesn't bother these theoretical questions about Bible criticism. That's not on his radar screen. What bothers him is, what does this mean about how we're supposed to live in the world and experience Hashem? And the answer is, it proves it's Sveidina, like a good Brisker. What does it prove? It proves, right, a good Brisker, if you're the Rambam, he says two different things. So he's going to start worrying about, well, what are the historical influences on the Rambam, and maybe he got this bitoy from like Arabic, and this bitoy from Aramaic, and maybe one is the influence of the Rif, and the other is the influence of the Bahag, and whatever. No, Brisker's going to say, the Rambam is the Rambam. Right? And I know I have complete faith in the Rambam. Question is, what does this mean? It means this faith in a dual obligation that we have halachically here. And that's exactly, that's what Lonely Man of Faith is. He says he's not bothered by historical questions, by metaphysical questions, by theoretical questions. That's all for the man of faith, for the person who's an object, who's just, oh, well, wow, what did this do to me, and what did that do to me, and how do I answer these theoretical questions? The Rav's answer is, you know what, if you answer the questions about Niha Yehudi, then the question of Niha Gorali will just, like, what if someone would come to the Rav with a big question from the perspective of Goral? I don't know what the Rav would have said. What he might have said is, you're asking your own questions. Ask the questions of Yehud, and you'll see, if you get the right answers to them, then you'll realize that those questions weren't important. Those questions only bother you because you haven't asked the right questions yet. And that's what the Rav did. In all areas of halacha, right? How did the Rav, other than in this essay, how did he address the question of, like, death and suffering, how we're supposed to react to it? So in Hilchos Avelos, he wrote all of that. The different aspects of Hilchos Avelos are telling us different ways that he's essentially confronting this difficult reality. But not explaining why someone died, right? Explaining how we're supposed to react to that in a way that adds something and brings something good out of it. And that's what's so important about Kol Dodido Fake. What's Kol Dodido Fake about? Which is two historical events? The Holocaust and the State of Israel. Right? What were a lot of people saying at the time? Well, Kol Dodido Fake was an address telling people to support Israel. What were a lot of people saying at the time? Right? Not so much anymore. But a lot of people were saying at the time that Israel, right? Israel is... Why did the Holocaust happen? The Holocaust happened in order to bring about the State of Israel. That's what the Zionists said. The Holocaust happened in order to bring about the State of Israel. And what did the Rav say? The Rav says, no way. We're going to say why God let the Holocaust happen? That would be ridiculous. That would be absurd, grotesque. We can't answer that question. But what does that mean? So then he's just like, has nothing to say about anything interesting. So the Rav's chatma called the Biofake, if you would continue reading, is that, no, we're not have the chutzpah to answer the question as to why God made the Holocaust happen. And then start getting involved in, you know, in how do we know, and this and that. No. Question is, now that it did happen, what is our reaction? And the Rav's answer is very clear. You know, the Holocaust is a terrible thing and we're not going to explain it away. We're not going to feel better about it. The question is, what obligation that imposed on us? And he says, clearly, the obligation that imposes on us is to examine ourselves and make sure that we are helping the Jewish people by supporting the state of Israel, by supporting Torah and the state of Israel, etc. So the Rav got to the same place that other people got, that secular Zionists got, let's say. Or that some religious Zionist got, said, oh, Hashem let the Holocaust happen because that was, you know, something you have to do a surgery, you know, to amputate a limb to save the patient, and that, you know, got us the state of Israel. And the Rav said, Chas v'shalom. We can never, who knows, Hashem has the answers, but we can't assume such crazy things about whether we know they're true or not about Hashem. But the question is, what obligation does this terrible suffering impose on us? It imposes on us the obligation to support the state of Israel. And so therefore, yes, your support of the state of Israel is based on the Shoah. But not because you know what God's plan is and you're God, but because that's the obligation that this suffering imposes upon us, is to look deeper into ourselves and take responsibility for the destiny, not just fate, of the Jewish people. And that's what he would say about all these things. And just like we mentioned about faith, right? He wasn't interested in proving God. He was interested in the nature of the experience of belief, right? When we discussed Emunah. And that's what the Rav discusses everything, right? He never told anyone why they should be from. He just told people what it means to be from. Right, what it means to be ish this and ish that, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and he inspired people to say, yeah, I want to do that. And then if people did it, they found it, you know, they found the meaning in it and the truth in it. Now the Derech of the Rav, the unique confluence between the philosophical and you, which said we can't really figure out the answer to metaphysics and theoretical philosophy, and the brisker Masorah, which said don't ask why. Ask what? And this is a classic example of the Rav, where he says, very mefurish, and that's the difference between Goral and Yehud. There is a whole, he admits there's a whole tradition of why. But he says that was never the answer. That was just people like covering up some side points for Nebuchim, etc., or making some side haros or special circumstances. The Iker is, right? Roy Student Bartolov, what should you do? You pasquish from Maisav, etc., etc., and even in Eov. What does he do with Eov in the end, famously in Kol Dibyotek? Says Eov was not sufficiently sensitive to other people, and then he learned to be sensitive to other people by the end. But he doesn't say, that's why Hashem made Eov suffer. He says, that's how Eov took something bad, and not justified it. Because you can't justify it. Justifying, then you're justifying the Shoah, then you're doing very difficult. You don't justify evil in the world. That's for philosophy, and that's for Hashem's perspective. But you redeem, right? You redeem it, not justify. Justify means you explain why it was Kedai in the first place. Redeeming means, I don't know it, I don't care what was Kedai in the first place. That's Hashem's job, not mine. That's an old Havel to understand why everything was Kedai in the first place. What I'm asking is, what came out of it in the last place, in the final, in the final result? And that's called redeeming suffering. That's the Rav's approach to everything. It's very empowering. Because ultimately what he's saying is that the whole world is up to us. And this is like, right, Lamont wrote this up. And, you know, I don't know if he quoted the Rav directly, but definitely in the philosophy of the Rav. The whole Rishis Michas Gula Seinu controversy, right? Should we say, should we not say? Is it Rishis Michas Gula Seinu? Isn't it Rishis Michas Gula Seinu? So Rav Lam said, based on the philosophy of the Rav, I don't know if you heard it directly, said the question is wrong. That's not what the answer, I'm not going to prove which answer is right. The question is ridiculous. You know whether it's Rishis Michas Gula Seinu or not because you know God's plan for history and the whys, etc.? No, we don't know the whys of the past and we don't know the whys of the future. We don't know causality or genealogy. What's the Rav's answer? The Rav's answer is, don't argue whether it is Reishis Michus Gula Seinu. It's your job to make it Reishis Michus Gula Seinu, says Rabbi Lam in a famous article way, way back in the 60s, I think, based on the Rav. Now, the question isn't, is it or isn't it? The question is how to make it Reishis Michus Gula Seinu. Now, whether that means you should say it in the davening or not, that I don't know what the answer is. But the answer is that, clearly, stop asking the wrong question about why and about Ani Hagor Li. Did Hashem do this as Reishis Michus Gula Seinu or not? Or the Satmar's right? Or, you know, the Chuli? No. Ani ha Yehudi, make it Reishis Michus Gula Seinu. And that's basically the whole philosophy of the Rav as one of the classic examples is here.
I don't understand. What does this brisk understand about the fact that the Rambam and the Mishnah Torah always at the end of the halachos put like agoros and tame halachos, you know, like at the end of the mikvos, like I don't know. So what place does that have for you?
So it's not that, again, just like the Rav. Is the Rav dry, like, if you read the Rav, do you get like, oh, just dry technical halacha? No, it's like beautiful philosophy. But, what was the godless of the Rav? The Rav is the only person I know in the whole history of the world who said, I'm only talking about halacha, not about philosophy, and managed to have all the philosophy. Because the Rav's unique talent, okay, I'm going to say what the unique talent of the Rav is, I never met him. Okay, but in my humble opinion, the unique talent of the Rav, more important than everything else, was that he was able to, within the halachic context, somehow end up having all the philosophy that you were so excited about, but in a halachic perspective and not in a theoretical perspective. And that's clear in all the Rav's writing. He doesn't end up dry and boring. He ends up just as exciting when people are discussing theoretical metaphysics. But it's all within a halachic perspective of Yi'ud and not Goral. And that's what you say about the Rambam. Of course the Rambam brings out God's lesson, philosophies, etc. But he could say that God's lesson, philosophy that the Rambam brings in the Mishnah Torah, as opposed to more Nevuchim, are because those have a halachic role to play and are not just theoretical questions. Those are practical questions about the nature of the Avodas Hashem that we're supposed to be accomplishing.
But still they explain the Madua, not only the Ma.
So the Rav would say they don't. You'd say it depends how you read them. Now, am I prepared to stand here and claim that all the Rav's interpretations of the Rambam are pashut shot and none of them are a little dachuk? Maybe someone else will claim that. I'm not prepared to defend that right now. It could be that sometimes you could say the Rav shot of the Rambam is a little dachuk. Now, I asked for Rosa Swag once. What about the Rambam Hilchos Panios that says, like, if a bad thing happens to you, you have to say it's because of our Averos? Isn't that exactly against the Rav? And he told me, no, you misunderstood the Rambam Hilchos Taniyos. What the Rambam Hilchos Taniyos meant is that a bad thing happens to you, you have to say, this is an opportunity created in the world by Hashem that we can redeem by using it to be a fashion meisim and fix our avirus. Not that you know why Hashem brought it. I asked him, is that Pashim Shad of the Rambam? He says, yes, if you know the right Hashkafa. So I admit that, like every philosophy, sometimes the Rambam will sound more like this, and sometimes it will not sound so much like this, and you don't have to say that's what he means. But that's the nature of Peirush.
In terms of how they understood these Rambams, and Avodas Chazal in general, what purpose did they have in the world of Ma?
The Rav would say, because all 99% of these, let's say, are not just telling you theoretical things. They're really telling you halachic chiyuvim.
But like you open the Shulchan Aruch, you just won't find them.
So the Rav would say that's because the Shulchan Aruch is on a basic level, but if you're but that was the godless of the Rav. By the time the Rav got through the lumdus on the deepest level, he had all these agadic ideas in there. The Rav would say, yeah, if you're just learning Shulchan Aruch, that's a Keter book, right? That's the Shulchan Aruch b'fnei every Baal of us. But if you understand halacha on the deepest level, which means lumdus, then all of a sudden you see how all these things are relevant. Now, am I capable myself of accomplishing the Rav's program every time I sit down for the Sefer Pesachim? I know I am woefully inadequate. Is Rav Rosenzweig capable of that? To a great extent. You know, most of the way. Was the Rav capable of that? Yes, and that was, you know, what made him unique and different from everyone else. Now, you could disagree. But that was his philosophy, and you could be consistent about it. You know, I can't say that I can do that in every sugya. Because, whatever, I'm not the Rav, and I'm just a regular person who tries to learn a little Torah. But that was the philosophy of the Rav, and that's what he talks about in halachic mind. You know, that's the whole idea. We're not going to go through it now. For various reasons, including my own aforementioned philosophical inadequacy. But anyway, okay, that's the basic, I think, the second installment this year. But understanding really where the Rav is coming from, what made the Rav unique, in another classic example.
So you're in a base other. So the Rav says he has tried and he's failed to console people with the why question.
Right.
With the classic philosophical. So what's he saying now? So he's saying you should walk into the base other and say, man up, you should, you know, take this for what it is. Obviously that's not gonna work either. So what are you left with?
So what are you supposed to say in the base other according to the Rav? So it's a good question because, you know, there might be different rules for the base Avel, you know, et cetera. Obviously, when it comes to death as opposed to other things, the answer can't be, like, let's fight it. I mean, if someone's sick, one of the things you can say is, okay, let's get the best doctors. Obviously, death is the one example where that doesn't work. So according to the Rav, I think what he would say is you're not going to make anyone feel better as saying, that your lowling, your child died, 2 years old. That's really for a great reason. It was the biggest tova and chesed Hashem could do for you. Even though that might be philosophically true, right? But the Rav, now you could disagree practically, right? The Rav seems to have sometimes had different ideas practically about what made people feel better than sometimes we see people feel. I don't know. The Rav would say that's not what you're supposed to say in the base of El. Maybe you're just supposed to be menachem the people and help them carry on with their lives and manage the burning. And maybe the answer is that you're supposed to talk about, what we can learn from this and what we can do to on the basis of this and the basis of the whole community's reaction, improve the community. And people do this sometimes, they start new community initiatives and they improve the world and they, have all kinds of new mitzvos, not new mitzvos, but new levels of kiyum mitzvos, after a tragedy like this strikes. And maybe the Rav would say, that's part of it. And now again, you have to know what you can tell someone and what the person can tell themselves. That's a very big practical difference. But there are people who, unfortunately, look, that's the thing. The Rav wouldn't say, it was kedai for someone to die because someone took a musr from it. But there are people who people die and they take a tremendous musr and change their whole lives based on it. And the advantage of the Rav is you have to say that if you want to make that connection make sense, you have to say, it's kedai for the person to die for you to take this musr. The Rav would say, no, I don't have to, I'm not trying to explain what was kedai. That's Hashem's business. But he has a trillion reasons that we can't keep track of. And there's no point trying to figure them out. But you can redeem this by making something good out of it, by taking a musr and changing your life. And I'm not saying it's pashut. And the Rav admits it's not pashut, especially when it comes to, big yisurin. It's more pashut when it comes to small yisurin. If someone's sick, someone has cancer, then you really can tell them, don't sit and think about why Hashem did this to you. Get the best medical treatment. And think about how when you survive, how are you going to make this a watershed moment that changed your life for the better? And someone really, it's easier to inspire someone with the Rav's message then. Obviously, it's harder to inspire someone with the Rav's message when the tragedy is greater. But that's true of any message. It's going to be harder when the tragedy is greater. Right. And, it might not be so simple. And maybe that's why in the Beis HaAvel sometimes, we're not supposed to say anything sometimes. But the Rav did say in a few places that part of Avelos is tshuva. Part of the kiyum of Avelos is tshuva. What he meant by that is not, I know why my family member, Lolenu died. But it's that now that I confront death and all its horrible reality, that makes me think deeper about what I'm supposed to do with life, and that spurs you to tshuva. And that's the Rav actually built that into his lumdus and avelus. Now again, does that mean that I should tell the person? Not depends right. What the person's ready to hear.
The Right.
And the Rav would say that...
Yeah, Sonia said it's right here, so I have to go watch the kids for the left.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she's a Rav-Olet.
Everything's done?
No, they found the paintbrush, so now she has to establish that she exists.
If you need an aid, then I'll
help
you.
Right, exactly.
Right, you can't you just tell them that she fixed?
No, they need questions at the beginning.
Right, the famous joke, right? The cart was, he's in a business class and the stewardess comes and says, would you like some coffee or tea? So they think, no.
You can't establish a strong connection. You don't have a strong connection on the top because they weren't. How did it go, Dami? Is the recording?
I'm not sure.
It is the recording.